And you'll recall it was, what, back in the spring that we had the big public hearing on the homeless crisis and shouting matches about taxes, and the council passed what we called the head tax designed to tax companies like Amazon, but that was quickly repealed when Amazon said, well, we might not build all those buildings down here anymore. And now Seattle City Council member Shama Sawant is out with an aggressive proposal to make up for the $50 million a year that tax would have brought in, and Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott has been looking into it. What does it say?
Dave, so after the repeal of the so-called head tax in May, city leaders said they were going to look for other ways to replace that money that was supposed to be used for homeless services and housing. But really, nothing has come of that promise. So Councilmember Shama Sawant is putting out her own proposals to come up with that money as the city council works its way through the budget process. She announced a budget amendment yesterday detailing three options for coming up with the $48 million lost in the head tax repeal. Among them,
stop the sweeps of homeless people. We know they don't give any good results and they are inhumane. Cut new computers in cop cars. No tolls on city streets. Cut mayor and council member salaries to the area median income. Cap city executive salaries at no more than $150,000 a year. And reduce the number of city executives because everybody has too many bosses. And eliminate vacant city executive positions.
Wait a minute. She's a conservative now. How many times have Republicans, the few in Seattle, called for cutting the size of city governments? That's what she's saying.
Right. Even Dory said he agreed with that yesterday, some of that. So all of those are a collective part of her first option, which also includes this controversial proposal.
Slow new police officer hiring because funding affordable housing and other initiatives to address inequality will actually help reduce crime more than policing.
I hear that might be self-fulfilling because the cops are so unhappy with that new contract.
Well, right. So this is a really big deal and would be a particularly tough sell because SPD is already dealing with a big, big staffing shortage and struggling to get new hires. And that's getting even worse now because that new contract that was so celebrated is now in question again. Yeah. So I asked Sawant how she could defend slowing the hiring of police officers because the chief has said that's a threat to public safety.
I would say, and I'm not the only one who says this, that the most dramatic threat to public safety is the serious income, gender, and racial inequality that we see in our city. The best possible thing that politicians in this city can do to improve public safety is to ensure that everybody has access to affordable housing.
So again, all of that with the slowing of hiring of police and the other ones mentioned above are all part of her first option. One of the other options?
So we say bring back the tax. And we should also point out how wrong the council members were to buckle under the bullying of Amazon, because it was through the strength and courage of workers that Amazon recently announced that they are going to give their employees $15 an hour. That shows that when you have a corporate bully, you don't back down. You continue fighting back because it does yield results.
So to be clear, that option was to revive the head tax, bring it back. So those are her first two options. The third is kind of a supporter of the first two. She wants to have the city take out $480 million in bonds to build, I think it's 3,000 to 5,000 affordable housing units. That would be paid back every year at like $36 million with money that comes from either option one or option two, essentially. So that's the budget amendment she put forward. And if she needs two of three city council members or two other city council members to support the idea in order to move it forward in the budget process. And if they don't like her ideas, she says that's okay.
If you have other ideas for raising progressive revenues and using it to fund social housing that is publicly available, permanently affordable housing, I am happy to sign on to it. I welcome those ideas.
Well, one of the ideas is to loosen up the zoning requirements and some of the city restrictions on the, what do they call them, accessory dwelling units, otherwise known as mother-in-law apartments, so that people can just build more housing.
Well,
and if you flood the market with housing, you know, the price goes down.
And that is a way to get some more housing. That's a separate issue. What she's talking about are all of these options are making cuts in the budget to replace that $48 million a year that was lost when the head tax was repealed.
Anybody talk about the cost of that tent idea
$3 million.
But why is it 3 million? You could build a solid building for $3 million, couldn't you?
And I would have to look in more to that. No, they have not discussed that at great length, and there's not a really piece of legislation that I can look at associated with that yet that has the details. I know the ones that were erected in San Diego come with about the same price tag though, estimating on that.
This is not out of the ballpark.
No, not at all.
And there is city land, right? I mean, there are vacant lots that are far enough from residential neighborhoods that people shouldn't feel spooked by it, where you could put up that. And I mean, people could put their tents under the tent, I suppose, if they wanted to.
Right, and there is. And I'm kind of looking in because we still have that emergency declaration, which supposedly was frees up any permitting or any necessities required to put something like that up. So,
yeah. All right, it's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Time for Choke Points, which is brought to you by Online Training Academy. Mayor Jenny Durkin is promising the days of overturned fish trucks shutting down Seattle for hours is over. There is a new response team on the job, and Chris can tell us what it's all about.
Yeah, most of us will remember the great fish truck fiasco of 2015 when a truck overturned on the Alaskan Way Viaduct. It took nearly 5 hours to get the thing back on its wheels, and then another 4 hours to get it out of the way. Seattle was basically shut down for 9 hours. And then we found out that the city really had no plan to respond to such a crisis. And when it did, the city leaders actually admitted that they were more worried about damaging the truck than getting traffic moving. The policy at the time was, well, let's err on the side of not damaging anything as opposed to opening the streets, which was ridiculous when they announced that. No more, says Mayor Jenny Durkin.
Policy now is, if nobody's hurt, we're getting things out of the street.
Life safety comes first, and then next on the list is getting traffic moving.
One of the things we've got to do better is clearing traffic problems. For every minute that we have a traffic, a fender bender stuck in the road, it's 7 minutes of backup. So every minute we delay our response, we have more backup.
Just raising my hand here, I believe that is the first time I've heard a mayor say that.
That is correct.
Is that
and that's
true?
Why it's being so forceful. Yeah, that they're actually admitting that the mayor is saying we want to get the streets open. And that's going to be our priority. If no one's hurt, get it the hell out of the way. And the mayor's front line of defense on this now is a handful of city of employees and 5 response team trucks. Just like the 75 IRT trucks that the state uses, they're going to push cars out of the way. They're going to give you gas. They're going to give you a jump. They'll get the roads reopened. The city has been running these trucks a little bit under the radar for the last couple of years, kind of getting them up to speed for this week's official launch. They've been training with the Washington Department of Transportation and the State Patrol. For drivers like Marcus Potts, sometimes they are the first people to arrive and find these stranded drivers.
It was dark outside and it was raining, so his lights was off. So I was able to find him there and was able to get him some help and get him up and going.
Yesterday, Potts and his crew moved a semi that was stuck on 23rd Avenue in Yesler. They just moved it and got it out of the way. So Potts has worked for the city for about 25 years in a variety of different professions. And he took this job, he said, because he enjoys helping people.
People are so relieved when they see you pull up. They see you pull up, you got your lights on, you got your board going. And when you get out, you got a nice smile, you got these bright jackets on. And they're like, wow, he's here.
Now, one of the more unique features of Seattle's response team is that it will be using pink signs to warn people of what's ahead. Those giant diamond signs you're used to being orange and black.
Right.
They're going to be pink. I'll explain in a minute. Pink is not Potts' first choice, but he says it gets the job done.
It gets people's attention. The signs get people's attention. They're a little different from, the orange and black signs, but they actually work. People slow down and take a look like, what is that?
It actually turns out that pink is the nationally recognized color for temporary traffic control signs.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, I didn't either. You had to read through the 7,000 pages of the National Highway Traffic Safety anyway to find it. It turns out that that's to give drivers a heads up that this is something different. This is not a construction closure, but an emergency and something that you actually have to maybe pay a little bit more attention to. So the city is going to be doing that. And the mayor believes that this crew and the new policy there of moving stuff first will be vital in helping the region get through the upcoming years of construction and downtown transformation, affectionately known as maximum constraint.
Now, what does that mean?
Maximum constraint. That's what they're calling the next 3 to 5 years of downtown Seattle, of getting around where we will have, obviously, the convention center area closed down, the bus tunnel closed down. We're having the tunnel and the viaduct being done, all the construction around downtown, maybe adding the First Avenue streetcar where First Ave is going to be shut down. The ability to basically, we're preparing for 3 years of never before seen bad Seattle traffic.
I see.
But maximum constraint.
I see. But at least now we are going to move the fish trucks as soon as possible.
Yeah.
The fish truck was on a state highway, though. The state has had these IRT trucks forever.
Right, but it was in the city of Seattle.
Oh, I see.
And that's the weird thing about 99 that we found out over the years, is even though it's a state highway, when it goes through jurisdictions, those jurisdictions are responsible.
Oh, I see.
So, the cities, I mean, they kind of moved at least part of, they could have just shoved that part of the way and at least gotten one lane open right away, but they didn't.
But the rule said no. Well, that's changing, and that's fantastic, because for my money, a really good accident response team that takes the job seriously, like the guy you talked to, it sounds like he loves his job and loves doing it. That's like adding an extra lane of highway. Isn't it really?
Yeah, it can. And these guys, just like the state guys, are going to be pre-positioned around the city, and they will roam as well. So they're going to be like, well, there's going to be one at the north end of the tunnel, one at the south end of the tunnel, one working, you know, the different major. And their idea is, okay, we go to the majors, we go to the arterials, and then we work our way down to, and then we roam, and we find, like he was roaming the other day on his way to an accident, Marcus was, and he found somebody else who was in trouble that was in a real bad spot, lights off. You know, in a dark area on a ramp to the West Seattle Bridge. He's like, okay, I got to get this guy out of here, or else he's going to get hurt, and it's going to back up traffic. And so it's nice to finally hear, after all the years of road diets, which we're still doing, and cutting parking and adding bike lanes and things, to at least say, okay, we're going to actually make an emphasis on clearing the streets. Obviously, if somebody's hurt, obviously, you know, all bets are off, because that's a priority. We all get that. And it's also up to the public, by the way. If you're in a little fender bender on Mercer, and you can move your cars, don't get out. Don't stop in the middle of Mercer and have a conversation with the driver. Take a picture, then get yourself out of the way.
Yeah,
and open it up. We have some responsibility in this as well.
This is my antidote for the anger. I've been doing this for a couple of years, and I mean it. Your daily dose of kindness. I really want you to believe there is goodness out there. Dialing a wrong number can sometimes lead to unexpected goodness. I know a couple weeks back, I got a wrong number call, and before hanging up, the man on the other line said in the sweetest voice, "Blessings and good health to you." It changed my whole day. But this story out of Nebraska is far beyond a pleasant greeting. Greg Holloman was being cared for by his sister after a spinal surgery. She finally flew home to Florida when all seemed well with him. But then Lisa got a call. Greg said his incision was infected, his left leg was going numb, he needed to get to the hospital. But as an Army veteran living on disability, he worried he couldn't afford an ambulance ride to the hospital and didn't think his VA insurance would cover it. So Greg's sister called his social worker, and she told the person on the other line everything, gave the young man on the other line the whole story, assuming it was Greg's social worker. What she didn't know is that she actually dialed a wrong number, and that put her in touch with the sandwich chain Jimmy John's. The store manager took the call and had to explain that she'd called a sandwich shop, but he said he'd help anyway.
Somebody needs help, and I guess it was just convenient that I work at somewhere where we have drivers.
He told KESQ-TV that one of his drivers was free and would drive Greg to the hospital. That driver, Zach Hilmer, is a veteran, too.
Till the day I die, if another service member needs help, then I'm going to do it.
So that's it. It was 9 miles total. Greg brought Greg to the hospital, and he got his treatment. And as so many stories of kindness do today, I should probably keep a tally. Lisa said she couldn't help but draw a bigger lesson from this act of kindness. And she told the Omaha World Herald, in today's political climate, everybody's arguing with everybody, and we're not actively listening to what anybody has to say. So to have two complete strangers listen to me and then decide to do something to fix it, it was amazing.
Because he could have just said, got the wrong number, lady.
Right. That's what you expect. And that's what usually happens with wrong numbers. You go, oh, okay, all right, bye, bye. But the guy who said, blessings and good health to you, to me, to this Jimmy John's shop's owner who said, yeah, I got a driver, let's get him there. Yeah. I mean, that's a leap of faith. That's an act of kindness. It really is the goodness that we all contain.
And I bet it was faster than the ambulance, because Jimmy John's is really fast.
They're freaky fast.
Freaky fast. Time for our Sports Insider. Direct from 710 ESPN, that giant double-wide tractor trailer truck of sports. Here he is, Danny O'Neill. The story of Chad Kelly, who was the backup quarterback for the Broncos, is pretty intriguing. He has not had good luck at hanging on to a job, even in this Buffalo economy. What's happened?
Well, from the outside looking in, you might think that he has certain behavioral problems that seem to be associated with alcohol. The most recent one is he went to a Halloween party hosted by his teammate Von Miller. He was dressed dark pants, white shirt, brown vest, colorful handkerchief, so we can assume as a cowboy.
Mm-hmm.
He proceeded to have several incidents with other partygoers, with the hired security when he was asked to leave, and then he went and let himself into somebody's house nearby the establishment, sat down next to a woman who had a child with her, and was asked to leave, began to mumble incoherently, and then was struck with a vacuum cleaner tube.
How does that happen?
Well, I guess the guy found anything close by. I would have used a Maglite. I've got one of those that's a solid. And then they called the police, and he was found in an SUV nearby.
Is this long-term substance abuse? Do we think that it's something that he should probably go to treatment for, or is he just an out-of-control drunk?
Who knows? And I've never even talked to the kid. He's the nephew of Hall of Fame quarterback Jim Kelly, but this completes a rare triple crown. He was booted off his college team at Clemson for arguing with coaches. He was been cut from his NFL job. He had to transfer high schools as well. He went to, after he got booted out of Clemson, he went to Last Chance U, which is quickly becoming a misnomer because that doesn't seem to have been his last chance. He then went to Ole Miss. There's also a couple different things. He was seen running onto the field in a fight at a high school football game involving his brother.
Wait, but apparently he's got some talent, right? Because they keep...
Yeah, he's got a great arm. Oh. Yeah, he's got a famous last name.
Not a great moral compass, I guess.
Either that or just has some things he needs to straighten out. And the one thing about it is if he does, and I don't know because I've never talked to him, if he does have a drinking problem, he was also arrested for disorderly conduct outside a bar. Like, that's the one thing that's this serious medical condition that you can fix.
Right.
Like, it gets well in a hurry.
As we know, not until he's ready.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the case with the substance abuse. I'm sorry, I have to go back to Last Chance U. Is that a real thing?
Yeah. It's in Scuba, Mississippi. It's a junior college.
Oh, okay.
They have a Netflix documentary that comes out each season. They're pretty fantastic. I think they've changed schools now, which they do. But yeah, they go to this little town. One of the members of the Seahawks played there.
Really?
Jaron Reed.
Why is it called Last Chance U?
Because they take guys who are
so
down
really
to their last
that.
Chance.
Okay, I didn't want to make fun if
big,
that was actually
their big donor is a guy named Harry Last Chance.
as Jaron Reed said, how did you end up there? He's like, well, with my grades, I couldn't get in anywhere.
Okay.
And I mean anywhere. So he went to Scuba, Mississippi.
Let's talk about the instant replay controversy in the Pac-12. I didn't realize the Pac-12 does instant replays too, where they send it back to the head office?
Yes, they have a command center, they like to call it, which cracks me up. Washington State, USC, this is a game from about 3 weeks ago. There were two different hits in the second half of that game, both of which were reviewed. No, sorry, one was reviewed, the other was not. Both qualified as targeting, as it's called in college football, where a defensive player hits the guy he's aiming for in the head.
Right.
And you get a penalty and you get ejected for that. The Washington State kid who was flagged for targeting, they reviewed it, said no targeting. The other one, Porter Gustin, late in the game, who hit the Cougs quarterback in the head, and if they'd called that penalty, Washington State very well wins that game. That wasn't even reviewed at all. Mike Leach became very upset and found out that there was a member of the Pac-12's football administration that was in the command center when that happened, and that the head... The guy who conducts the replay review, who has the final say on it, that's clearly designated who the replay official is. And he felt he was overruled by the football administrator, someone who's not an official, not a trainer, not anything
and
like that.
And is not a neutral party.
No, presumably not. He works for the conference. But Mike Leach, a number of his text messages, which he sent from his university phone, have been disclosed because they were of Woody Dixon is the Pac-12 football administrator's name, and the contention is that someone who should not have had any say in the call ended up having the final word of it, and they've since revised it, and that guy's not going to be there anymore. But some of Leach's texts are worth reading. Woody is a total coward and is afraid of USC. I look forward to telling him in person. Leach, this one is to the commissioner of the Pac-12. The Pac-12 cannot say with any credibility that they are actually trying to protect student athletes. There's also one where he says that don't ever waste my time making me sit through some sanctimonious speech or demonstration on player safety or targeting if you are going to continue to alibi what happened last Friday.
My goodness.
But that's been changed now.
Well, kind of. The Pac-12 has also told the Oregonian that we don't actually have a manual governing replay review. And within about a half an hour, the Oregonian found an 11-page document that was titled Manual for Pac-12 Instant Replay
yes.
Review. And I saw Larry Scott on Friday out at Washington State, out at Pullman. They're walking through, and that is very much a jeans and T-shirt crowd. And I'm like, who are the idiot investment bankers that are walking here? It was four guys who looked like they were ready for the night at the Roxbury. And nope, it was the Pac-12 administrator.
Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Thank you, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
It is now time for another edition of What's My Health Insurance Going to Cost Next Year? Because while 2019 is still 2 months away, State Insurance Commissioner Mike Kreidler, who wants to remind you that open enrollment is only a week away, has some advice.
It's literally going to affect several hundred thousand people in the state of Washington, and it begins on November 1st, goes for a month and a half until December 15th, at which time you'll have an opportunity to select the health plan that you want. You can either do it inside of the exchange, health insurance exchange, or you can buy it outside of the health insurance exchange. And outside of the exchange, you wouldn't receive any subsidies, but if you're eligible for a subsidy, you want to buy inside the exchange so you can take advantage of that.
Next question is, how much can you expect to pay? And it's not as bad as it could have been, but it's still going to be substantially higher.
We had initial filing rate a request from the health insurers for inside the exchange at 19% rate increase on average. We were able to work with them, knock it down to about 13%, but that's an average. And so what really behooves people to take a look and see which health plan they have, which one they want, what the price is, make the choice for themselves, because they can find some health plans that are having less of a price increase for 2019 than others.
And 13% is also the average increase for your employer plan.
For outside of the health insurance exchange, they should be very similar. In fact, a number of the plans that have been approved for inside the exchange, several of those are also offering outside of the exchange. They're very comparable in most cases, whether it's inside or out.
So 13% premium increase for next year, and with inflation at about 2%, once again, we see the cost of health insurance going up at a little more than six times the rate of inflation. So there goes your pay raise, unless you've been getting pay raises of 13% a year. If you were making, say, $50,000 a year in 2008, a pay raise of 13% a year would see you making $170,000 today. So that's the key. Start insisting on 13% annual pay raises, then you can afford your insurance. Actually, if insurance rates weren't going up so fast, you might actually be able to get a higher pay increase because your company pays a big chunk of your premium. The other thing to be aware of is that as expensive as health insurance is, there can still be some nasty surprises when you try to use your coverage because of all the different deals insurance companies cut with doctors and hospitals. You may go in for treatment at a hospital that's on your company's list, only to find, according to the insurance commissioner, that some of the doctors who treated you at that hospital were not on the list.
Not atypically, what you run into is somebody who winds up being hospitalized, not infrequently through an emergency room. And once they're hospitalized, they may wind up having a surgical procedure performed. The hospital is in network, so you make assumptions. But then after the fact, you may find out that, oh, well, the emergency room doctors are, even though it's in the hospital, are not part of the network, or you had a surgery and the anesthesiologist that we had to use is outside of what is in network.
Surprise! And that can mean a bill thousands of dollars higher than you expected, even when you've done your homework and you think you're in the right place to be covered by your plan, which brings us to the midterm election and the issue that, according to pollsters, is at the top of the list.
And that is to protect individuals who have a pre-existing condition. You have a Texas lawsuit right now that is in federal court in Texas, which some 21 conservative attorney generals are a party to, that would eliminate the Affordable Care Act and expose individuals with pre-existing conditions to finding it impossible or unaffordable for them to have coverage for a pre-existing condition. You do not want to try to deal with the cost of metastatic cancer or multiple sclerosis without having health insurance coverage. It's going to really help you. But what we're talking about here at stake in this election is a push by some conservatives to abolish the Affordable Care Act and expose poor individuals with pre-existing conditions to horrendous costs that can make the difference of life and death.
State Insurance Commissioner Mike Kreidler. I should point out that the president has promised that pre-existing conditions will be covered, and it's true that Congress can impose that requirement, but once Obamacare is gone, there would be no limits on what those policies would cost. There is a possible solution to that. I saw an ad from a life insurance company selling policies for people with pre-existing conditions so at least their families can pay their bills after they die. So the free market does have a kind of solution, not ideal perhaps, but it's something. Do you trust your kids alone with the computer? It's still the Wild West out there. Facebook has been trying to do something about it. In one, we've talked about the whole fake news thing, but the other thing Facebook is trying to do is find ways to prevent this online child pornography. That's a particular crusade of CBS tech analyst Larry Magid, who joins us now. What is Facebook trying to do, Larry?
Well, what they're trying to do with use artificial intelligence and machine learning to find these illegal child sex abuse images, and that's actually what they're called now. They really aren't pornography. That's a common term. But they are pictures of children being sexually exploited. And so if they can get them off the system right away, they might actually be able to do it before anybody sees it. And they claim that they're getting rid of 99% of these images before they're reported. So if indeed this technology is working as they say it is, it pretty much makes it impossible for somebody to post it because they're detecting it in real time.
And they're using artificial intelligence to do this?
Yes, and they didn't go into a lot of details, and I don't think they will because they don't want to give away right. the secret sauce. But I think that what they're talking about is analyzing images, looking for telltale signs as to are they likely illegal images, and then having a human being very quickly look at them to make that determination, because there's going to be false positives. I mean, you could have a person in a bathing suit, which the software thinks may be an inappropriate picture. Now, I'm sure they've done a lot of work to eliminate those, but I doubt very much whether they've completely gotten rid of the false negatives.
One of the aspects of this, you're right. One of the aspects of this that I hadn't thought about was that when they were doing it the old-fashioned way by having human beings look at these images and decide which ones were a problem, that some of these people, after spending an eight-hour day looking at this stuff, were getting PTSD.
You know, I'm on the board of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and even though I've never had to look at this content, we have employees that do it all the time, and we provide psychological counseling. We rotate people in and out. So it is a very difficult job, and it's something that you really have to be on top of it. So I do have a great deal of sympathy for anybody who has to deal with these images.
So generally, going beyond Facebook now, do we see any meaningful punishment for people who are caught putting up this stuff, or are they able to pretty much mask their activities?
Well, if they're caught, the punishment is very severe. Even possession of this kind of content is a felony. It's tough to catch them. There are people who are caught, but of course there are ways, not just Facebook. I mean, they're the dark web, highly encrypted sites, the file sharing networks. There are all ways that people can attempt to mask their identity. Having said that, there are plenty of examples of people being arrested for these kinds of crimes. So I don't think you have impunity just because you're hiding behind a keyboard. There are still forensic tools that authorities can use to find people.
And how are they going to handle it once you are able to deepfake anything? You've seen the deepfake software, right, where you can take politicians, make them say anything. I assume at some point, you're going to get people doing this with child porn. They're going to argue, well, it's not a real person. We just deepfaked it.
There was actually a Supreme Court case on that about virtual child porn, and that was one of the reasons why some people disagreed with the court's interpretation, because a defense attorney could come in and say, no, this isn't a child. This is just an illustration that my guy did on a computer. Yeah. But the other aspect of this I want to point out is that if this technology works, It could be applied to fake news. It could be applied to trolling. It could be applied to bullying. It could be applied to a lot of different use cases in addition to child pornography.
Right. And has there been any decision then on whether that kind of thing is legal or not?
Oh, yeah. No, the court allowed that it is legal as long as a real child is not depicted. So
really?
That was a very controversial decision. Some people, and you know, the argument is they're not thought police. You can still imagine or take or draw. But because the purpose of the child pornography laws originally was to prevent the exploitation of real children.
Right. But in the case of a deep fake that actually that portrays a recognizable figure, recognizable politician, that would get you in trouble?
Oh, the politician. That's a different issue. Because the other issue is, of course, threat, intimidation, and also normalization. One of the problems with these kinds of images is they normalize. People will show these images to children and make them think that there's something normal about children engaging in sexual situations with adults. So that's one more reason why child pornography is so dangerous.
Larry Magid, CBS tech analyst. Larry, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.